Welcome to Next Gen Mentoring Forum. The Next Gen Mentoring Forum series is to empower, educate those who are interested or already in the financial planning industry. At each forum, an expert will discuss topics in the field of financial planning with the purpose of inspiring critical thoughts and discussion. In today's session, I will interview Dr. Ekta Kumar on how to counsel clients without shaming them. My name is Dr. Jolly Jen. I am an assistant professor and director of the financial planning program at California Lutheran University. I maintain an active financial planning practice specializing in succession program management at Value Growth Institute. I've authored three award-winning books, most recent peer-reviewed research book published by Pellgrip Macmillan, entitled Enhancing Retirement Success Rates in United States. Next Gen Mentoring Forum is sponsored by California Lutheran University School of Management Financial Planning Program. We offer MBA in financial planning that helps financial advisors pursue a leadership position to grow their financial planning practice by developing advanced financial planning skill and effective client communication and counseling, as well as streamline the practice management. Today, I have the honor to interview Dr. Ekta Kumar. Dr. Kumar is a licensed clinical psychologist. You have to excuse my pronunciation here, who received a doctoral in clinical psychology from University of Indianapolis. At the University of Indianapolis, Dr. Kumar was a diverse fellow and served on diversity advisory board for the School of Psychological Science. Dr. Kumar has developed workshops, continuing education program related to diversity, trauma, clinical practice for students, staff, faculty, and clinician in Indiana and California recently. Dr. Kumar was the director for community counseling service right here at California Lutheran University, and is now a director of diversity and inclusion initiatives for the Department of Psychiatry at University of Southern California. She is also an assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry and provides college students at University of Southern California with therapy services. In her private practice, she specializes in working with LGBTQIA+ individuals and POC. Dr. Kumar has a variety of training and experience of providing therapy, outreach, prevention programming, and facilitation of difficult dialogue relating to trauma and diversity. Finally, Dr. Kumar has presented at various national conferences and is published in Journal of Multicultural Counseling and Development. So welcome, Dr. Kumar. It's been a while. Since I last saw you.
Yeah, thank you so much for the introduction.
And thank you so much for doing this. I think the very first time when I met you, we got into a conversation about shaming. And at times when I was working with clients early on in my career, I noticing that sometimes clients cry in my meetings. And for a while, a lot of my colleagues actually laugh at me. They're like, you make your client cry. So before we get into much of the discussion today, can you briefly tell us what is shaming before we get into a discussion about it?
Sure. You know, I think sometimes generally we use the words like guilt and shame very interchangeably. And yet they're really distinct. You know, when there's a feeling of guilt, you know, it's something usually behavioral, it's constructive, it helps people change habits that they would like to. So for example, if a financial planning client says something like, you know, I really shouldn't have spent so much on shopping, you know, it's a behavior, they're noticing it's something they wanted to change. But whereas with shame, it takes a very different element. There's usually a judgment about the individual's personhood. And when we go into this place of shame, it's very paralyzing. It's hard to make change when you feel, you know, overwhelmed by that emotion. So for an example of that might be someone, you know, an indicator of shame might be when they're making comments about themselves, such as like, you know, I'm terrible. I'm terrible about finances. I'm no good. I'm no good at this. Those are those statements that are more indicative of shame than guilt. And most of us, like I mentioned, we get stuck in that place when we are sitting in our shame. So that's something that I'm glad you're kind of differentiating.
And so what you're saying is that when clients tell you that I'm not good at money, I'm not good at investing, I'm not good at saving, that in, underneath what they're saying is that they're feeling shameful. And so from an advisor's perspective, what should we do when we hear something like that?
You know, and those are statements that I think kind of just responding with empathy of like, you know, finances are hard. We're talking about something really difficult that we're raised not to talk about, you know, so this stuff is difficult for most people, but it's something that we can work on together. You know, a lot of times, you know, I'm in more of the therapy realm. And so this comes up in different ways for people. And I try to point out those moments of where it's sometimes it's a skill rather than a character flaw, you know? So, you know, this is something that we could work on together. You know, this is something that we can shift rather than you're just not good at something and that's just how it is. So not buying into that.
Okay, so I'm glad to hear that your definition of shaming is basically a judgment as part of it. But when we hear something from clients talking about they're not good at certain things, we should have the empathies for that. Now, I wanted to kind of ask something quite interesting where it may not show in a virtual environment, but when you are meeting with clients in person, sometimes our body language could potentially also shaming our clients. What should we do to not do something like that? Maybe we just didn't know that we're doing that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of the beauties of the virtual environment is we can see ourselves now, right? So that's something that is really helpful, you know? And I appreciate what you're bringing up of so much of what we say is nonverbal. And so, you know, when you're noticing you're feeling frustrated or you're starting to check out and maybe looking at your phone, looking at other things, perhaps you just had a really busy day, you know, and yet to a client, it can appear very differently, you know, in a virtual situation. There's so many more distractions now that we're doing, you know, everything virtually. But I think kind of to the point of like watching your body language of like, are you sitting back, crossing your arms, or are you trying to kind of make sure you're as best as you can, making eye contact with them, nodding and doing all of those verbal, nonverbals that we would easily pick up on that we almost in some ways have to exaggerate a little bit when we're in this virtual environment.
Oh, that's interesting. So we almost have to exaggerate a little bit in the virtual environment so clients actually can see it clearly, I guess.
Yeah.
Now, so one of the things that I picked up when you were talking about judgment, and I wanted to kind of circle back on that, because oftentimes, not necessarily our verbal or physical kind of movement could present judging. So from an advisor's perspective, what can we do to avoid things like that to kind of reveal that we're judging, even though we're not trying to?
So is your question kind of how do you manage those like nonverbals?
Right. Nonverbals, yes.
You know, I think one of the pieces that's really critical is what leads to a lot of these things is sometimes our own biases, right? That we have about certain individuals or certain behaviors. And, you know, I think a lot of times when people come into spaces and they say like, I have no biases, like I'm super accepting of everything. That's just not true. As humans, we all, every single one of us has biases. And when we try to ignore those or pretend that they don't exist, we can't do anything about them at that point. So being able to kind of sit back with ourselves, you know, if you have a really frustrating session with a client, like sitting back and thinking about that, reflecting, what was that about this situation that was really tough for me? What came up for me? You know, were there any of my own biases at play here? And when we're able to actually identify those and not pretend that they don't exist, then we can actually say, okay, I'm going to consciously make sure I'm not doing that. And how do I seek out, you know, individuals or people of different experiences than myself, so I'm actively working against those biases that come out in those nonverbals, but also sometimes more overtly in statements that are made to clients as well.
And so one of the example I can think of, as maybe this is a joke, but years ago when my mother-in-law was asking me opinion about Social Security, and of course, mm-hmm. you know, you're in the field, you always encourage clients to delay taking your Social Security for whatever the reason. There are tons and tons of benefits. But what I realized that at the time, I was more of telling her, which is a bias, right? It's a bias on my end that we think people should always take Social Security at either full retirement age, you know, later on, so you can benefit from the dollar amount. So that was a bias first. Then I felt like my mother-in-law, I couldn't convince her. I couldn't convince her to actually do what is right for her. So I think that those are probably one of those biases that you mentioned. It could be a certain type of rule of thumbs that we have in the industry that we tend to ask clients to do or advise clients to do. So I think that we probably shouldn't assume these rule of thumbs. We should probably listen. What's the reason why that particular person wants to take the Social Security at 62, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's probably, I'm thinking about that in terms of bias coming from the rule of thumbs from the practice itself. But I think there's another type of bias that you mentioned, and that could be also cultural. Mm-hmm. So for example, if I were to counsel an Asian family, I knew that I am in no position to argue about not paying your children's education, right? In the Asian family, Asian Americans family, that's not negotiable. So besides the rule of thumbs and besides the cultural part, are there any other type of bias that we should pay attention of?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you mentioned really important ones. You know, part of me and I is thinking about, you know, each individual has, as you said, different familial values, different cultural values that drive their decision-making, different obligations, maybe whether it's to, you know, their church or their temple or even to their own, you know, family. But also if we think about mental health as well, you know, a lot of sometimes with certain diagnoses or challenges that people are going through, we do see increased spending, gambling, job instability, poor money management. And, you know, when I was especially at community counseling services where we did work with a lot of underinsured individuals or low income families, you know, we also, one of the big reasons people came to therapy was for financial concerns. So, you know, obviously biases are not just limited to culture, but they can be around all types of identity, whether it's sexual identity, gender identity, et cetera. But when I'm thinking around financial planning, exactly what you said, sometimes the questions aren't being asked of like, what are this individual's values? And I think about an example of, you know, individuals who might be sending money back home, but they're in debt right now. And so as a financial planner, you're in this tough spot of, it might be easy to say something like, well, that's something that we could easily stop doing. Or you're making kind of the, like you said, maybe blanket statements of like, okay, stop getting your nails done or stop doing XYZ. And immediately we have all this saving. So being able to, like you said, ask those questions, understand, you know, what is important about this for this individual? How do you meet them halfway? How do you still provide your counsel, which is critically needed, but in a culturally sensitive way as well? One more piece.
So what you're saying is sometimes that is not necessarily directly giving clients the answer. So for example, when you say, you know, they're in debt, they need to send money back home. And our typical statement would be, you should stop doing that. So instead of saying that, we should help the clients to self-discover or come up with a solution themselves. Is that the right approach?
Well, I obviously, you all are the experts in financial planning, so I'm not going to pretend to know how you all do the magic that you do. Some of the things that I'm thinking about would be, you know, starting with empathy before the intervention, you know. So, you know, for example, that example of an individual sending money back home, you know. So starting out with even something like, it sounds like you're carrying a lot of responsibility. You know, you're trying to provide for your family as much as possible. And then asking those questions, like you said, you know, okay, so how much of your paycheck are you sending back home? Do you know what expenses you're helping out with the most? I really encourage people, not even in therapy, I avoid using a why question, even though it might be completely innocuous, it has a different feel when you're on the receiving end. So instead of saying something like, why do you send that money home when you clearly need it to pay your bills? Saying, you know, what makes you prioritize sending this home rather than paying this debt that you have here? And then, as you mentioned, kind of, you know, brainstorming solutions that honor their values. And also you're pointing out the positive aspects of it too. So, you know, I admire your commitment to your family. And are there any other individuals who could also help? Or, you know, I really admire your commitment to your family. Are there any ways you could also support your family if we pulled back a little bit here? You know, so we want to make sure we're meeting your financial goals, but we're also honoring your values. Those are ways of,
wow,
you know, pulling the person in. What do you think about that?
I think that's it takes a time to do what you just mentioned, because you say, what makes you prioritize such things, right? And to also not just value what their value is, but we also have to listen well, right? We have to listen deeper as well, because it's not just, obviously they wouldn't be in front of us if they don't have a problem. So we shouldn't be just pushing them down, further down. There is a questions in the chat box regarding about how do we get around on the biases for rule of thumb, such as, you know, you can take Social Security at 62, but if we encounter that with a client, what would you recommend in terms of working around that kind of bias, other than asking, since we couldn't use why? So what would you recommend?
You know, working around our biases, I think that's something that we all have to do in like all parts of our life, right? And it does start with first just that reflection of like, where did I learn this? Where is this coming from? How might this person's worldview situation might be different than mine? How do I understand that? And still engage that person, you know, for example, like you said, you know, there's a lot of benefits to waiting to pull this from Social Security. So, but however, I hear that this is really important that you do need this money right now. Why don't we talk about a few other options as well? And let's make the one that's best for you. So maybe you notice, okay, I want to just tell the client not to do this, but instead kind of opening up that conversation.
So you basically not only acknowledging that what they just said, but then not necessarily jump right into a conclusion, but let the clients, well, listen, basically ask additional questions. So in my mother-in-law situation, mm-hmm. after I learned that I didn't do a very good job of convincing her, I know I learned later that I cannot convince anybody anyway, that the reason that she wants to take Social Security at 62 was because she had already retired and that money would have supplemented her for medical insurance. So I think that oftentimes it's just one more step of asking additional follow-up questions, we as advisors or planners or counselor will be able to kind of find out mm-hmm. why, instead of using the word why.
Right. I even think about a personal example of, you know, my family, we immigrated from India. I was born in India. My family worked really hard, you know, here. And so anytime we had savings, our family, we took a trip to India. That's, you know, where our family is. That's where we went. You know, but as I got older here, I felt like I haven't seen the world. I was in grad school for way too long, you know, so much student debt. And, you know, I remember talking to my father of like, you know, I want to take this trip to Spain. And for him, it was just mind boggling. Like, you have this much in student debt and you're thinking about going to Spain? Like, are you crazy? Like, this is what you do in your the end of your life when you have savings, you know? And again, it's sometimes just that mismatch of values and, you know, recognizing like, I'm going to be paying this debt off for years. And yet I haven't seen any of the world. And that's something I really value. And I think about a financial planner in a similar situation, thinking like, what are you doing right now? But being able to ask that question of like, you know, it seems like travel is really important to you. Talk to me about that. What are some of your goals around that? Let's see how we can find a good middle ground for you.
I learned that you use that word a lot, middle ground. So I'm going to start using that going forward. One of the other questions that I have is, what can we do to avoid unintentionally doing that to clients? And sometimes I don't know about it until people tell me, but a lot of people are very polite. They will never tell me. So how would I know if I unintentionally shaming clients? Mm-hmm.
That's a hard question. I would love to hear from people who are, you know, viewing in as well of those times where it was a little unclear. I'm thinking, you know, of situations where your client stops engaging, they stop coming, you know, of course that can be for a variety of reasons. So I don't want you to think every time it's because there is shame, you know,
right.
But it could be something. They seem checked out during the appointment. You feel like you keep hitting a dead end. You're working harder than they are in that session. Something's going on. And these could possibly be indicators of the client's feeling, you know, shame. Maybe it's not due to what you said, but what they're caring about their personal situation. It's very tough. You know, sometimes when we do something day in and day out, for example, with you all, you're talking about money all day, but most people never talk about money. And I think about the same thing in therapy. I'm so used to talking about emotions, but most people are not doing that for 50 minutes, you know, every week. And so just remembering those pieces, or if you also notice you're saying statements that like, you know, that's not important to be spending on, or you're making those blanket statements. Those could be other signs that maybe, you know, some shame is coming across, or monitoring your own discomfort. Are you feeling uncomfortable working with certain clients, or you're feeling extra frustrated at the end of certain sessions? I don't think that's something you should ignore. It's something that means, okay, there needs to be some more reflection.
Interesting. So it's not just necessarily what we say. We also have to self-monitor our own reflection from what the clients are telling us. And that's very interesting. I have an interesting question, but I'm not sure if it's related to this. So I heard the word be vulnerable, and I'm trying to figure out, does that have anything to do with shaming, or is it something completely different?
What part did you mean from being vulnerable?
Yeah, I heard people say that being vulnerable, that you can potentially grow in some way. So I'm curious about what that word actually means in terms of helping our clients not to be shameful. Or I don't know if that makes any sense.
I'm not sure I'm fully following you on the question, but part of me is thinking, you know, just I'm wondering if some vulnerability might be, and as far as like, you know, even the financial advisor recognizing and saying those things of like, you know, I've struggled with this stuff too. This is hard, but we're going to work together and sort this out. And that's you showing your vulnerability of like, I didn't know all of this coming into it, but I'm not sure if that's what you were referring to.
I think so.